I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with Anita Dalton of Odd Things Considered. Odd Things Considered is a book discussion blog focused specifically on books of an outre, bizarre, and or taboo variety. Whether it's serial murder and true crime or cults and conspiracy theories, Odd Things Considered covers the books that you won't see discussed in most literary journals. And moreover, it attempts to give these off-the-beaten-path reads a thoughtful, in-depth analysis that is usually only afforded to high literature. Which isn't to say that Anita is some serial killer groupie or tinfoil hat-wearing nutter. On the contrary, she refuses to romanticize violence and is a hardened skeptic. Nonetheless, she remains interested in all things offbeat. A compilation of Anita's greatest hits has recently been published by Nine Bandit Books with the title TLDR, The Best of Odd Things Considered. With all this in mind, I thought that Anita would be a perfect guest for Parallax Views. To transition into the conversation, I've got a weird cut from the ever dark, damp, frog-filled swamps of, let's call it alt-YouTube, I guess, entitled Pizzagate Macaulay Culkin Remix. Yes, Anita and I do discuss the ever popular, at least amongst shut-in Reddit and 4chan hikikomoris, Comet Ping Pong John Podesta DNC pedophile ring conspiracy theory, arr, Alex Jones, right? You trolls. Well, I guess we get weird musical numbers like this one out of it. So, is that a win? I don't know. Maybe. Anyways, I hope you guys enjoy my conversation with Anita Dalton, and I assure you she provides a reasoned take on Pizzagate, unlike the track you're about to hear.
People like me from previous months, okay? Total control. Bing, bing, bong, bong, bing, 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 bong, bong, bing, bing, bong, bong, bing.
Cheese pizza just for me.
crust first.
Lovely cheese pizza, just for me.
Bing, bing, bong, bong, bing, 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 bong, bong, bing, bing.
Together, and Mac is very smart and he's very ingenious.
Why did you light this thing?
Rust first.
Lovely cheese pizza, just for me. Did anyone order me plain cheese? Pizza, just for me. Pizza, just for me.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Anita Dalton.
Hello.
So I wanted to have you on the podcast because you have an interesting book out from Nine Bandit Books called The Best of Odd Things Considered. And Odd Things Considered is your web blog, and it covers your book reviews, but it's not exactly run-of-the-mill book reviews. Could you tell us a little bit about the blog?
Sure. It's basically the place where I go to write endlessly about the books that interest me. It started off sort of as a traditional critic sort of blog where I and I reviewed books, and it gradually morphed into more of a discussion-oriented blog where I simply reacted to the text without really applying any sort of is it a good book or a bad book application to it.
Right, right. And it's kind of very specific in what it covers. It doesn't cover the type of books you may see in like a literature class. Like it's not necessarily reviews of like Philip Larkin and Ezra Pound.
Right. No, I tend to specialize in odd or weird or outre books that covering from, you know, strange literature to conspiracy theory to the paranormal. If it's a weird book in some way, chances are it will eventually make it onto my site.
So what got you into the more outre side of things, these sort of odd books, these sort of overlooked gems and oddities?
It's kind of hard to pinpoint, but I guess I was an extraordinarily lucky kid in that I grew up in a suburb of Dallas that had a pretty good library. And I quickly read my way through most of the kids' books. And because it was the late 70s, early 80s, parental permission wasn't needed as much for me to start going into the adult stacks. And as a kid, I had access to all of these books that would sort of appeal to a slightly childish intellect that wanted to read more adult books. Like I was drawn to books about ghosts. I was drawn to books about, unfortunately, about killers and things like that at a very young age because I had access to them. And I think ultimately that's how I did it. I guess I have a strange nature in some regard to want to seek that out. But I think having early access to literature without a whole lot of restriction is how I came to be the adult who reads all of these books.
So were there any, I used to read books on hauntings and true crime when I was younger. Were there any particular cases or books that you can remember about hauntings or true crime stuff that come to mind?
Oh yeah. I used to know quite a bit about Hans Holder's cases. I used to read all of his books and I still have a few of them in my bookcases. And I think the first true crime book that I read and was transfixed by was Helter Skelter about the Charles Manson murders. That was one of my first forays into true crime.
Yeah, it's interesting. Vincent Bugliosi sort of crosses over into the conspiracy world, albeit as a skeptic with his JFK stuff. Although I know, he was also really into like this. I guess he contributed to some work that Probe magazine when it came to the RFK assassination. He actually contributed to some of their theories that there was a cover-up of RFK. So Bugliosi is like this weird character that gets into the Manson case and then JFK and then RFK in a more conspiratorial way. It's really interesting.
Did he get into the whole process thing as well? The notion that Charles Manson and Son of Sam were linked through the process church? Did he have any belief in that?
You know, I don't know. I think that's more Ed Sanders. But the process is interesting because that was sort of a Jesus freak cult, and that's another topic that comes up in some of the books you review.
Uh-huh.
You know, this issue of cults. You know, what is it that you think fascinates people about cults?
For me, I get drawn in by the notion that somebody is willing to give up their self in pursuit of this higher purpose. I guess it's what fascinates me about religion too. But with cults, the sort of asceticness that always seems to follow with them, the things that people have to give up, the hard work they have to do, those stories always seem very compelling to me. And also, unfortunately, there's probably just a little bit of rubbernecking involved too. Just the stories of people who survive more virulent cults are generally pretty compelling.
Yeah, when you read about, like, there's been a few books that have come out in the past year or so about, you know, Jonestown survivors. And I think one of the ex-Manson family members just came out with a book. I can't recall the title of it right now, though. There's all kinds of books like that coming out in the past few years.
I haven't read either of those. I'll have to keep my eyes peeled. The most recent book I read about a cult, and I don't know if it's necessarily a cult, was the book about the Process Church by Isis Aquarius. Not the Process Church, I'm sorry. The Father Yod's Church by Isis Aquarian. That was the last book I think I've read on like an actual authentic cult. And it is debatable whether or not that was a cult in the true application of the word, but it came close.
Was that the Source family?
The Source family, that's right.
In LA?
That's right, the Source family.
What was their whole thing?
They were sort of a Jesus freak offshoot in a way, but they were vegetarians, free love in a way, group of young idealistic people who gathered around a charismatic older man, and it was not a situation I think that most people would have want to lived in. There were like 100 people crammed into what was essentially a small Los Angeles mansion in the beginning, living in little cubby holes. But it was also very carnal. It had a very bacchanalistic 60s feel to it. It was a pretty compelling book. If anybody out there is sort of into that whole sort of 1960s searching for idealism while having lots of wild sex, that would be a pretty good book to start out with.
Well, that's also something we see when we talk about, you know, the Manson family. There's that whole Charles Manson is this like weird guy that's like giving LSD to women and like having sex all the time, and then, you know, you have the murders with Sharon Tate and stuff. It always seems like sex and violence come back to these like weird topics.
Oh yeah, they always do. It always seems to loop around in one regard. Either that or Satan. Sex, violence, or Satan.
Yeah, have you reviewed any books on that side of things, like the satanic subculture?
You know what? I don't think that I have, which is a stunning oversight. But yeah, I haven't. I haven't done a whole lot of left-hand path things. I should. I should look into that.
You have covered the great Danzig's books, though.
Oh, yes.
Len Danzig.
Yeah, I have. Those were a hoot.
So you were saying that you're interested in, you know, cults because of the way they interact with belief, and it's the same with religion. Another big topic that you cover a lot is conspiracy theory. How'd you first get into conspiracy theory?
Same way I got into just about all the other stuff. I read a book about it when I was a kid from the public library. It took me a while to embrace the notion that there maybe was something hinky about the assassination and
of JFK?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it took me.
Do you remember the book out of curiosity?
Oh,
I'm just curious.
God, no, I don't. I was a kid. It was years and years ago. I've since read, you know, some of the usual suspects in the Kennedy assassination. My husband is far more into it than I am, but I have come around to the notion that there might have been a CIA plot to kill Kennedy. I couldn't necessarily, outline it like a lot of people who are true believers in the notion that there was a plot to kill Kennedy within the United States government, but it does have enough strange details and things that never really quite work out when you try to puzzle out how everything went down.
Yeah, there's so many like really weird conspiracy theories that come out just simply out of the Kennedy assassination. One of the books you review, and I actually have it on my shelf, it's a bit of an odd one. I think it's by an author, George Picard. It's called Liquid Conspiracy.
Oh, gosh, yes. The janitor who found the secret to the universe, right? Is that the one?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. That was a read, wasn't it? That was an education.
So with books like that, it's interesting because I've always thought of you more as like a skeptic. Like you say, you know, you're open to conspiracy theories about the JFK assassination, but in general, you're pretty critical of most conspiracy theory topics.
I am. I tend to subscribe to the whole Occam's razor thing, that if there is a simpler explanation, I tend to go with that. I can be tempted off of that path when I find it more difficult to come up with reasonable explanations to the questions that people are raising. But generally, I do tend to be a skeptic. I think that a lot of the conspiracy theory that comes out is almost akin to religion. It's a desperate attempt to try to understand terrible things that happen in the world and try to make sense of things, especially random things that are beyond our control. So that's one of I'm not a particularly religious or spiritual person. I think that might be one of the reasons why I have difficulty embracing most conspiracy theory, because it relies on a tremendous amount of belief that I don't think I'm capable of giving a topic.
I was going to ask, what do you, when it comes to conspiracy theories, one of the books you've reviewed is The Franklin Cover-Up by John DeCamp.
Uh-huh.
And I've always been very, I don't know, I've always found the way that some people are interested in that to be like very unusual. Like I sort of have to wonder at times, I'm like, are they fulfilling some weird like wish fulfillment fantasy by being so into this, like almost like a Peter Sotos type deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a bizarre conspiracy theory about like child trafficking and the government. And, you know, John DeCamp claims Chuck Norris was a part of it. John DeCamp was the senator who wrote it.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know about the Chuck Norris thing. I always got so hung up on the Hunter S. Thompson thing that I was fairly frothing at the mouth when I first read that, of the accusations that they were making against Hunter S. Thompson. For those who aren't familiar with it, the Franklin scandal was basically, it did have, there was some terrible stuff that happened there. The credit union was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. And I don't think it's far-fetched to think that possibly Larry King, the man who ran the savings and loan, that he was involved in some sort of unsavory activity with children. But it really devolved from there into like these explosively crazy conspiracy theories, like where, let's say, George Bush 41 chartered children from Nebraska to go serve as sex slaves at various GOP functions, or that Hunter S. Thompson was recruited to film snuff films where children were killed having sex on film. Yeah, it went from something that was very serious that could be proven into something that was completely lunatic. And I think that might be a problem with conspiracy theory, too, is I think sometimes it takes the focus off the real problems like government corruption and focus it instead on the unprovable, like that Hunter S. Thompson filled child porn.
Yeah, it's interesting because I see a lot of people bring up the claim from that book about Hunter S. Thompson, and it all comes from only one source, this really shady photographer by the name of Rusty Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no other sources for it, and yet people quote it like it's like some proven documented fact.
He got that, and didn't he say he got that information from Paul Bonacci, the chief accuser, the kid who won the $1 million suit against Larry King.
Yes, although how he won that was kind of weird.
Yeah, it was a default judgment. But the sole source that I think that this Rusty guy is quoting Paul Bonacci, and Paul himself is a very shady person. I've never really been able to find out a lot of information about who he was and where he came from before he started making all of these accusations in the Franklin scandal case. So, and if his claims are to be believed, he's a person who suffered quite a bit. And if you don't believe them, I still think he suffered quite a bit because he was used by forces who had an axe to grind against the GOP at the time. But yeah, the willingness to basically smear the character of a man who whose entire career was focused on exposing corruption and the sorts of scandals that would be involved in something like this, it astounds me, the willingness people have to smear somebody's entire life work based on such flimsy testimony.
So are you a fan of Hunter S. Thompson? Like, what do you think of his work overall?
I like Hunter S. Thompson overall. I relate to the paranoia. His sense of humor always connected with me. And I am glad I did not go down the route of complete and utter substance abuse the way he did. But I see the world in a similar way, that sort of paranoid, but at the same time, relatively skeptical mindset that he brought into a lot of his writing. And I also like the fact that he was willing to submerge himself down in investigative reporting and associate with people that most reporters would probably not want to be around.
Well, I mean, people know about Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but they often forget about, you know, like you said, one of the ones I think of with what you just mentioned is Hell's Angels,
mm-hmm.
where he infiltrates the Hell's Angels Society. And there's a really telling part of the book near the end where he like gets beat up by the Hell's Angels after spending months with them. And he's like all scared and like hobbling back, I think, to his hotel. And he can't understand like why they turned on him like that. It almost sort of reminds me of this sort of sense of anger with people that feel left behind and alienated with the rise of Trump. You know, like the Hell's Angels, ultimately his relationship with them broke down because he's from a different world than them. He was a guy from UC Berkeley and they sort of viewed him as an outsider.
Correct. Yeah. That's actually a good way to view what's going on. The sort of suspicions that people have developed towards whom they consider political elites. Trump sort of appealed to that, inexplicably, this really rich man appealed to that more common man, Joe the plumber sort of ideal, this notion that the common man was going to be able to take over the country again. I don't know how those people are feeling now, but I think a lot of other people looked at it and said, I don't know if this billionaire is going to be able to fulfill the promises that he's making, but that's a good way to look at it. I would never have filtered that through Hunter S. Thompson getting beaten up by the Hell's Angels.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting parallels you can make. I mean, even when we were talking about the Franklin cover-up stuff, I mean, it almost feels like we're seeing a repeat of that now with Pizzagate.
Yeah. Definitely. If you perused the Vote Pizzagate community, you'll see the Franklin scandal come up periodically. It's definitely a part of the core of Pizzagate, the notion that there is this group of wealthy elites who feel free to use and abuse private citizens and their children however they see fit. It fits in very nicely with some of the Pizzagate theories.
What do you think of the whole whole Pizzagate thing? I'm very skeptical of it myself, and I think it's like it has potential to turn into like a mob violence thing, as we saw with the guy that went to Comet Ping Pong with like an assault rifle.
Yeah. Oh, you know, a lot of the people in the Pizzagate community have said that was just part of the cover up because evidently he managed to shoot the computer hard drive that would have had all the information on it. So a lot of people in the Pizzagate consider that shooter to be part of the greater conspiracy, part of the cover up. But you know what? Please re-ask the question. I got, I was talking about the guy who shot and now I forgot what you were asking me.
Oh, I was saying like, what's your basic take then on Pizzagate and sort of the conspiracy culture around it, because I think it can get dangerous in a way.
It can get dangerous. And just like people willing to utterly smear the names of Hunter S. Thompson, you've seen people absolutely willing to go to any length to ruin the names and the public lives of people that they consider part of Pizzagate based on some very, again, very flimsy information. But the way I kind of view Pizzagate, once you get past the complete irrationality of all of it, there is quite a bit of it that is not, that doesn't really pass Occam's razor's test of what you, of the simplest explanation for the, for what they're seeing. I think it's actually a natural outgrowth of a loss of control in the political realm. I think that a lot of the people who take up, who make up the Pizzagate community are people who feel very disenfranchised, who are looking at people who are in control, people who have money, people who basically can and do control the lives of citizens in this country, people who can decide tomorrow whether or not you're going to have a job, people who can, through banking regulations, determine whether or not you're going to be able to keep your house. And they feel very suspicious about them. They feel very suspicious about this cadre of elites who seem to control everything. And if these people seem to control everything, looking at them suspiciously, the strange things that, the name of Hillary's advisor, the guy who...
John Podesta.
Right, that's right. When you look at some of the things that John Podesta wrote in those emails, I guess if you're part of that elite group, they make sense. But if you're like me, if you're just a suburbanite sitting in your house reading these emails, it seems really weird. And it's not that hard to start wondering if there is a code that these people are talking in, if they are doing things that are distasteful. They certainly do a lot of things that we discover in the political realm that are distasteful. Maybe they're doing more. So while I dismiss it, I think I understand on some level the paranoia and the anger that fuels the willingness to believe in the whole of Pizzagate.
Well, it's interesting, too, on the topic of Podesta. A lot of people I know who are into that old Pizzagate thing always point towards the artwork he owned. And I've said to people, I'm like you and me, by their metric of the artwork he owned, we're like devil worshippers, too, because we read like weird books about sex and violence and death and shit.
Right. They have I think it's actually his brother who owned all of that with his ex-wife, Heather. I can't remember that Podesta brother's name either.
Tony,
that's right.
I think it was Tony.
Yeah. Yeah, some of that artwork is pretty out there. There's some of the theories that people have about it, especially Marina Abramović, is fairly disturbing. But I've had this conversation with my husband, too, that if the FBI ever searched the house on the basis of my book collection, we'd probably be in a lot of trouble. So, yeah, I guess it's hard for me to think that reading books and owning bizarre art is that much of an affront, but it very well may be, because some of it is a little weird, especially one of the sculptures. I don't remember who she did it, but they're convinced that it was based off of a Jeffrey Dahmer murder, when really it wasn't. She started creating these sculptures before Dahmer was ever captured. But it's a headless man whose body's contorted. I think it's called something like the Arc of Agony or the Arc of Ecstasy or something like that. It's clearly a tortured headless body. And so when you walk into, again, if my grandfather saw that piece of art, he probably would have been a little startled and possibly suspicious of the person who owned it.
Right. Well, I can get that too. I grew up in you know, this suburban environment, mm-hmm. where I would be reading books by like released by Feral House, like Apocalypse Culture, right? I remember the one time I was reading Sex and Rockets about John Parsons in study hall, and people were like looking at me and like grabbing the book and being like, what is this? Or I was reading Crash once.
Oh, Ballard?
By J.G. Yeah. Ballard. And a bunch of girls were like asking me to like see the book, and I gave them the book, and they're just like looking at it like horrified, you know, when they're flipping through the pages. So I could see how suburbanites would get, you know, weird about stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Not to condemn suburbanites as being these utterly provincial people. I mean, I am one too. But I think sometimes because I have a college education, and I'm, again, relatively lucky in life that it's easy to look at these points of view and think, what a bunch of rubes. How could you possibly believe that? And I try to temper my skepticism with enough understanding as to how they get there. But it's no less disturbing to think that somebody's entire life could be ruined just because they have some outre art.
Well, not just that, but I know you've covered this this culture online that is now arising whenever the mass shootings happen.
Right.
This idea that everything's a false flag, you know, the Alex Jones types. What got you onto covering that? Because that sort of ties into this.
I don't actually know. I guess it's just part of all of the oddness that I find myself interested in. But I think back, it's probably the September Clues Forum was the first thing that got me into the whole "it never happened, we were all fooled" sort of way of thinking. The notion that that 9/11 didn't happen, it was all crisis actors and done with holograms. I don't actually know how that could have happened that way, but they're fairly convinced and have exhaustively documented what they believe to be the truth. And seeing that and trying to wrap my head around how anybody could really truly believe that 9/11 didn't happen, that those buildings didn't fall, that planes didn't crash into them, that all those people didn't die, was extraordinary to me. And then when I started seeing it happening in smaller events, it's a curious mindset, isn't it? It makes you wonder at what point anybody ever really dies in their mind. Does anybody ever have an accident in the mind of somebody who believes that the Newton shootings never happened, that everybody's a crisis actor? At what point in history did anything really happen that was real? And I think that if you start to approach your life and politics and current events with this notion that it's all this sort of grand theater meant to deceive us, that's a fairly exotic and interesting mindset that would be hard for someone like me to not look into.
Yeah, it gets into another book you've reviewed. I think it's called Voodoo Histories, about why people believe in this stuff. What's your take on why certain people feel a need to believe in these sort of grand conspiracy narratives?
It's to go back to the notion that it's almost like religion. It's a way to take hold of that which you cannot control, assign it a meaning, and assign it a greater understanding that isn't as terrifying. It's awful to think that at any time you could go to work and somebody could come and shoot up the building or fly a plane into it. And that fear causes you to want to create or to understand how it happened in a way that you can see all the strings that tied it together. And if you know everything that happened that caused it, perhaps you can try to avoid it. If you feel like you know everything that went into the creation of the conspiracy of 9/11, potentially you have the answers to avoid such tragedy. And I think that that's why people believe some of the false flag or great disaster theories. When you get down into stuff like, you know, the protocols of the Elders of Zion and things like that, or people who believe that everybody who ever assassinated a political figure was a mind-controlled Manchurian candidate, that's harder to nail down for me, even though I've read Shermer and, you know, and Aronovich and other people of their way of thinking. It's, I think on an individual level, I think once you get down into the more nitty-gritty, smaller conspiracies, it starts to become confirmation bias. It's sort of like you have a suspicion that a certain group of people behaves a certain way. You find this conspiracy theory, it all falls into place for you. So I think that might be why some of the smaller or older conspiracies still have their appeal.
Yeah, I know. I've talked to some people since you mentioned the Protocols of Zion thing. There's this evolutionary psychologist, Kevin MacDonald, who thinks the Jews have this like evolutionary group strategy and it all like makes sense of the conspiracies. And I've always just taken it as he's just sort of this old academic wasp that is like uncomforted by the fact that times they are a-changing, you know. Mm-hmm. Feminism has changed the world. You know, the cultural landscape is much different now. And it feels like a lot of conspiracy theorists, particularly the more right-leaning ones, the right-wing ones, mm-hmm. they need something to make sense of not having the same cultural grip that they, as, you know, white men may have had like 50 years ago.
Well, that's something that comes up quite a bit in the Utøya, Norway shootings with Breivik, and the sort of hatred of feminism and what they consider to be the Frankfurt movement of Jewish communism is how they look at it.
Well, they call it cultural Marxism, yeah. But that's a code word for Judeo-Bolshevik.
Right, exactly.
In their speak.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a quite a bit of that plays out in a lot of conspiracy theory because times have changed. They are radically different. And if you find yourself in a position where, you know, I'm sympathetic to the notion that it can be hard to be a human being, period. But, and I still have sympathy for the notion that, people who grew up with an assumption that they were going to be able to hold a job, have a family, and that their lives were going to be just like their father's, you know, with a long marriage and a long tenure at their work, feel very betrayed by the way the world has changed. But I think that betrayal also starts to become fodder for such extreme self-pity that they do turn to, some of them do turn to these extremist views, like the notions of Fjordman and Breivik, the idea that we would all be sitting in an office like madmen, you know, with our wives at home making dinner, our kids coming home and talking about what they did at school. And it would all be this perfect 1950s fantasy if it wasn't for all those feminists, you know, or if it wasn't for Muslim immigration, or if it wasn't for whatever it is that they feel has denied them their rightful place at the head of the table.
You know, that gets into another interesting thread. You know, you're of course associated with Nine Bandit Books, mm-hmm. who have released a number of books dealing with antinatalism, which is the idea that people shouldn't procreate.
Correct.
And it's interesting because one thing I can sort of take from antinatalists, even if I'm sort of I don't necessarily agree with them. I have a few friends that sort of identify as such, but one of their points that sort of goes against these sort of incels and these right-wingers that think, oh, if only we could go back to the 1950s, the antinatalists seem to have this point that, no, you would probably be miserable even if you were married and had the 2.5 kids.
right, yeah. No, that is a point, that for many people, life is not worth all that you have to endure to have the perks that make life worth living, I guess, in a way. That sort of sounded strange. It's not worth living to have the things that make life worth living, but... Yeah, that is a key point of antinatalism, that for many people life is not a gift, and that maybe harking back to the old times isn't going to get you the satisfaction that you would like to have out of life.
Right.
I don't necessarily agree with it either, but I can certainly see the allure. I can see why people adopt that point of view.
Well, that's one of the great things about you. You're willing to grapple with people you disagree with. I know we talked about in some of our email exchanges before the show about, you know, this issue of free speech, mm-hmm. and your belief that, you know, no platforming is probably a bad idea for the left. How do you feel about the whole free speech and where it's headed, how it is on campuses, the debates about it right now?
I find that, as a liberal, I do find that incredibly disheartening. I think I understand why so many young leftists want to control the narrative so tightly that they do not want anybody they disagree with to speak, because I think that they navigate the world in a way that's different than I navigated it, because I grew up with the assumption that I wasn't going to be drowning in college debt. I grew up with the assumption that I was going to be okay after I graduated from college, and I largely have been. When somebody makes a rape joke in front of me, when somebody says something offensive about my gender or about my race, which actually doesn't, I think of too many times anybody's ever insulted me about my race since I'm white, but I have enough in the cultural bank to where those things aren't the horrifying affront they are to somebody whose only achievement in life is going to be the respect they demand from others. I mean, so many of the kids who are graduating from college don't have the job prospects that I did. They are drowning under debt. the political climate right now, Donald Trump being president, I still have a hard time believing that that happened. You know, how did we come to the point that Donald Trump is our president? The world seems very aggressive, ambitious to them. And if they're controlling their environment very stringently. And I understand why they want to do it, but it is an extraordinarily bad idea because the pendulum never stops swinging. And the match that your grandfather lit will eventually be the match that burns down your house, if that makes any sense. Once you get certain ideas accepted in the cultural mind, it's very difficult to stop them. And if we on the left engage in relentless censorship or the refusal even to listen to people that we disagree with, we are going to eventually be tarred with the same brush. The pendulum's going to swing back. It always does.
Well, I mean, I get that too. The only thing I would push back on is what I personally find really aggravating is a lot of these people that identify as alt-right, mm-hmm. and they'll openly admit this now. I know Richard Spencer was recently asked about Richard Spencer was asked if he actually believed in free speech. He said, no, of course not. That's just a toll. You know, so you have a lot of people that are acting in bad faith.
Right.
And leftists have a right to get mad about that, I think.
True. So what he's saying is that he's giving the illusion of being in favor of free speech when he's not. I'm not. What was the context?
Yeah. That's what he was saying. He's saying, well, we say we're for free speech, but really, if we ever get into power, we're not. That's just, it's a rhetorical tool, in other words.
Yeah, it's hard to avoid that is the way these things seem to happen. Whoever's in power, again, tries to control the narrative. I think maybe, I guess that is true. I don't know. I try to take people at their word just because I have a hard time knowing what anybody really thinks. But yeah, I guess that is something that somebody who values free speech like me needs to be aware of, that perhaps it could be seen as a tool that people might seem open when really they're just telling you what you need to hear in order to buy their agenda.
But at the same time, I get where you're coming from. I think it was Angela Nagel who wrote Kill All Normies. She said a while back in an interview, you know, in the 70s, feminists would run circles around Norman Miller, who was real anti-feminist. Mm-hmm. They would run circles around him in debates. And it's just odd because it seems like the left can't do that anymore. Maybe the young leftists need to sharpen their debating skills and get angry again and learn how to, like, debate a Milo Yiannopoulos or something.
That would be great. That would be something to see. I would love to see a vicious exchange of ideas like that, where people who aren't easily offended yet are ardent believers in their political ideology just get up and go for it. That would be wonderful. And it is again disheartening to see that so many people, especially young people on the left, are unwilling or possibly afraid or to do that. I don't know. You're quite a bit younger than me. Do you identify with that sort of? Do you have any? Clearly, you're pro free speech. But what do you think it is that motivates the absolute refusal to debate among younger people in the left, especially college age?
Well, I think some people we shouldn't necessarily debate. Like for instance, like Matt Heimbach, you know, who was the Traditionalist Workers Party or whatever. Who was like an open neo-Nazi. I don't see any need to like platform someone like that. But with someone like Milo, I can't understand why people wouldn't want to debate him because a lot of his arguments seem like straw men anyways. You know,
yeah.
I think a lot of people are just almost scared to debate at times, or they think that they can't do it. The opponent is too strong, when I don't think that's the case.
It is kind of puzzling that people were afraid of Milo. He always struck me as just sort of being a glib guy who was sort of in on a joke that even people on his own side weren't getting. So yeah, that would have been nice to have seen, instead of, you know, losing her mind and yelling at him, to see Trigglypuff, the young woman who was so derided in the media. It would have been much better for her to have gotten up and tried to debate him. That would have been far more interesting, I think, and far more effective, really.
Yeah, no, I think the left can do it. A lot of the arguments people like Paul Joseph Watson make, or Alex Jones, they're not really that strong of an argument. They're sort of just putting up straw men, and there are people on the left that do play into those straw men. But I think things are moving in a different direction now. I think people are getting much more serious with the rise of Trump, hopefully.
Yeah. I think there has been a change in tone lately. You're right.
So the next thing I wanted to move on to, if you have the time, sure. Is I originally wanted to have you on because I'm working on a series of podcasts paying tribute to the recently passed Adam Parfrey mm-hmm. of Feral House. How did you become familiar with Adam Parfrey and Feral House Publications?
It's hard for me to say exactly when, because when I was in college, it was sort of a nexus of weirdness in Denton with the Subgenius groups and with like Discordian offshoots. And there was a lot of general weirdness that surrounded me. But I think I first became aware of Adam Parfrey in 94 when my boyfriend, now husband, and I went to Forbidden Books in Dallas, and I just saw the title Apocalypse Culture. And I didn't know at the time, I had one of the first, they were selling one of the Amok books, first editions, and I lent it to a friend and never got it back. This is probably one of the books I've purchased more than any other, because I always lend it and I never get it back. It's one of those books that's sort of an entryway for anybody who's interested in the strange, the hidden, the forbidden, the bizarre. And once I read Apocalypse Culture, it was like all these strange doors started to open for me. It was basically an entrance into a strange hidden world. I had an idea existed, but didn't know in detail.
Yeah, and Adam was another person that was like, you know, ferociously in favor of free speech, because he'd you know, Apocalypse Culture would have like real right-wing thinkers in it. Mm-hmm. And then he would have, I'm trying to think of the author, John Zerzan, mm-hmm. you know, the left-wing primitivist guy.
Right.
You know, so it was in all kinds of different crazy directions.
Right. Yeah, I know you have James Shelby Downard's Masonic theory of the JFK assassination.
King Kill 33.
Yeah, exactly. In the same edition as like the Confessions of Karen Greenlee, the female necrophile. It was one of the first exhaustive compendiums of outsider thought that I had access to. Outside of, I think, High Weirdness by Mail by Ivan Stang, I think would have been one of the other books that was like an entryway into just all of the weirdness that was out there pre-internet. But yeah, it was a book that didn't necessarily take sides on any particular issue. It was just more interested in finding the story and telling it.
Right, and Adam followed that up with Cult Rapture, mm-hmm. and then the long-awaited Apocalypse Culture 2.
Correct. A Cult Rapture, I know more about. It's been a long time since I've read Apocalypse Culture 2, but I read about Cult Rapture on Odd Things Considered. That book was, I found it darkly funny more than I found it particularly revealing, because by the time I'd read it, I'd been immersed in enough internet culture to where none of it was that surprising, but it was still, especially the stuff on the Uranus, was it the Uranians? The Uranus cult with the... that crazy
yes,
woman.
The Uranus cult.
Yeah. Mrs. Slocum from Are You Being Served was like this cult leader. I can't even think of what I'm trying to say now, but Cult Rapture was one of those books too that again was a door into a very interesting, strange world that many people had no idea existed.
Well, it's interesting too, because if you read Cult Rapture mm-hmm. close enough, a lot of times he's alternately being sympathetic at times, but he's also mocking the subject a lot. Like when he interviews Bo Gritz at one point
yeah.
in the book, and he's somewhat sympathetic towards the anti-government position of the militias. But by the end of the interview, he's like, Bo Gritz is insane and he's probably an FBI informant.
You see it coming up in other ones with people who aren't as incendiary. Like he seemed to have an almost palpable disgust for one of the women who was the Elvis Presley fan fiction writer. She also did Star Trek fiction, or just the kind of sad dankness of her life, the filthy litter box in her bedroom. And there was another kind of borderline sex cult of people who were disabled. It was supposed to be sort of an uplifting look at people who overcome their disability to have a fulfilling sex life, when really, again, it was this dark, dank group of people who were terrible people who just happened to be disabled. So yeah, there were a lot of times where like palpable disgust was evident as he was looking at his subjects, which, you know, it happens. Sometimes you come across enough grossness that you can't really remain as objective as you'd like to be.
Right, right. And I mean, it's crazy because I think a lot of people forget, you know, Feral House was really the precursor to so much when it came to like the 90s counterculture. I'm not sure you would get like disinfo or websites like Above Top Secret without Feral House first.
No, I think it greatly influenced the turn of conspiracy culture and forbidden culture online. I'm sitting here thinking about it. Like when I was in my late teens and early 20s, the access to unusual information that I have now would have just been overwhelming and stunning. I think that being able to read it in little bits or read it in books where I have enough distance from it maybe enabled me to not get sucked into things like conspiracy theory or into cult knowledge or cult affiliation, because I wasn't thrust into it. Like I wasn't thrown headfirst into the deep end of the pool. I had time to acclimate before I dove in. And I think that having Adam Parfrey's body of work as a young person who was interested in the strange, it did. It enabled me to get a perspective of weirdness without having to interact with other people, without having to have arguments, without having to do anything other than digest the information. And that for me was invaluable.
Right, right. Yeah, it does afford you a certain distance, and Parfrey provide a certain sense of humor that can take you down a more skeptical but open-minded route.
Right. Right.
And that sort of what makes me want to get into one of the book reviews I told you I wanted to cover. Mm-hmm. Is this book 1996,
oh, yeah,
by Gloria Naylor.
Oh yeah.
Because Gloria Naylor also comes out of a sort of a literary background like yourself. Mm-hmm. But she goes in a completely different direction than skepticism. Could you tell my listeners who Gloria Naylor is first?
Gloria Naylor is an acclaimed fiction writer. She wrote The Women of Brewster Place. It was a favorite book of Oprah Winfrey, and Oprah Winfrey actually played a role in the film adaptation of that book. She's also written other well-received novels, like I believe Mama Day was another one of the books that she wrote. She's not quite up there with Toni Morrison, but she is considered one of the more acclaimed Black female writers of her generation. And she moved to a small island off of South Carolina in a summer home in 1996 and ran afoul of a local woman whom she calls Eunice Simon. And she killed one of Eunice Simon's cats by poisoning it. She kind of coyly pretends that she didn't, but the cat had been coming into her garden and digging things up and pooping in her tomatoes or something. And she put out poison for something she called tree rats, and of course ended up killing the cat. And she and Eunice Simon began a small feud over it. And from that feud, she believes the seeds were planted for a full-scale government-backed stalking against her.
Targeted individuals. Correct. Targeted individuals was, is what they call
right
it.
She was a victim of gang stalking, right? And it's difficult to talk about, because through that entry I've had so many emails from people, and then if you read the entry itself, so many comments from people who themselves believe that they are targeted individuals, who are almost heartbreaking in their need for someone to believe what is happening to them. And I have a slightly different perspective on 1996 than I did when I first read it. When I first read it, I was actually kind of angry at the literary community and this for basically saying, well, isn't this an interesting look at, you know, the way that race relations play out in the United States? When really, to me, it was a look at a woman who was having a psychotic break and nobody was giving her the help that she needed. But after having read about when the FBI files on the actual targeting of Ernest Hemingway, it became harder for me to completely dismiss all of what it was that Naylor said she experienced. Of course, she didn't experience a microwave that could enter her head and have a conversation with her and urge her to kill herself. But it may not have been so unlikely that on the basis of being involved with the Nation of Islam through the Million Man March and things like that, that perhaps the government was looking at her. And that's the...
Well, there's also another side to what she's getting at when she's talking about the harassment.
Okay.
Is I think she mentions that, and I think the literary establishment ignores this, but doesn't she mention that the neighbor was in the ADL?
Oh, yes.
Or the JDL or something? Like, she's sort of implying that it's a Jewish plot.
It is. And it, I don't remember if I addressed that in the entry or not, but it is. She believes that Eunice Simon and she believes Eunice Simon's brother is an official in the NSA, and that they are both Jewish, and that she believed that something that she said to Eunice in a supermarket was misheard as a racist slur, and that on the basis of that racist slur and the dead cat, that the Jewish Eunice Simon and her brother decided to take her down. And because she had those tenuous links to the Nation of Islam, they were able to give focus to their investigation of her. And she believes, of course, that it went beyond just racism, that it went into a Islam versus Jewish sort of struggle.
It gets back to the religion thing once again.
Yes, it does. No Satan or sex, but religion definitely.
And I can definitely see what you're saying, how sort of collective harassment could be very possible, given Hemingway. You know, I think the FBI documents on that just got released, that they were monitoring him pretty closely.
Right.
And he was legitimately paranoid about that, but he turned out to be right.
Yes, he was. And I know A.E. Hotchner, too, was appalled when he found out, because he was one of Hemingway's best friends, and even he did not believe all of the stories. But it turned out, yes, that there was somebody in Hemingway's circle of friends who was a government informant, that yes, they had tapped his phones. Yes, they were monitoring all of his communications, because he had had a role in he did try to launch sort of his own party in Cuba, sort of a political party. But, you know, he was right. He was being tracked. Nobody believed him. So if that could happen to Hemingway, I had to ask myself later, why could it not have happened to Gloria Naylor? Well, it could have happened in all of that detail, but, you know, it becomes harder and harder to dismiss people's paranoia the more you read about this sort of stuff.
Right. It's like a rabbit hole.
Yes, it is. It is a rabbit hole.
But one of my friends wanted me to ask, because they found out I was interviewing you, they read your book and they wanted me to ask you about your book discussion that you did of the book Gates of Janus.
Oh, yes.
By Ian Brady.
Correct.
Could you tell my listeners about Ian Brady and Gates of Janus?
Ian Brady, was a notorious killer, from Manchester, England. He and his girlfriend Myra Henley killed five young people, and it was a very notorious case, especially because they took pictures of and did an audio recording of their assault and on a young girl named Leslie Ann Downey. He went to prison, and he wrote a book that was supposed to be he was trying to present it as a serial killer looking into the minds of other killers and giving you heretofore unknown knowledge that that only a killer could see, right? And the book for me was an enormous load of garbage. The more you read about it, the more you realized it was a man who didn't really know that much about what he was talking about, and that he was himself so psychologically unstable and disgusting that it was hard to read too much of the book without becoming angry, or at least that's how I perceived it. A lot of people loved the book. A lot of people thought it was, like, you know, one of the best applications of Nietzschean's will to power that they'd ever read. You know, I did not come away with that conclusion.
Yeah, I don't know. I always found Brady's whole thing about, you know, I killed Leslie Ann because I had to show that I was beyond good and evil and morality. I always found that just to be a cover. Because to me, I'm like, well, maybe he should have gone into a bar and tried to get into a bar fight. He probably would have got his ass kicked.
Right, right. No, he was. He was a man who preyed on the weak, or people who were socially disenfranchised enough to be weak. And even when he preyed on the weak, he sort of needed a charming woman to help him do it. He wasn't particularly good at anything that he did. It was just that serial murder of children wasn't with forensics and the way that people have been able to advance in profiling, he would have been caught far earlier on had he tried to do this in the 90s or the 2000s. So.
Well, he tried to get a third person involved, and that's what, you know, basically ruined
right,
it.
Right, right. David Smith. David Smith was, I believe, the husband of Myra Henley's younger sister. And yeah, he was absolutely appalled. They completely misjudged his character. And he did. He turned on them. He is why they got caught.
And that gets into this issue. You know, in a way, it's possible to be critical of publications like that coming out. Mm-hmm. Because it's like with Charles Manson or Ian Brady, people want to give what they did a philosophical sheen. But, I mean, especially with Brady, when you really dig beneath the surface, I don't think that's what's going on, do you?
No, not at all. He killed children because he wanted to kill children. He killed children because...
Right, and he liked playing mind games with the victims' families afterwards.
Oh, yeah, and that was just disgusting as well. Yeah, one of the women was just hopeful. Winnie Johnson was hopeful that he would tell her where her son's body was buried before she died, and he never did. And there's been dozens of people who saying, oh, yes, well, Ian told me exactly where Keith Bennett's body is buried, and they're never going to find him. That was one of the ways that he tormented Bennett's mother, was by coyly trying to get her to think that he would eventually tell her where he buried her son. That was just repellent. Yeah. And I try not to get too moral about things, but I always end up filtering it through my own worldview. And it's just like, oh, he was just such a disgusting little man. It beggars belief that anybody found anything worthwhile in anything that he said. It's one of those cases where I can see why young people may want to close down debate. I can't see why anybody was really a fan of Ian Brady.
Well, he always wanted to act later on like he was the victim, too.
Oh, correct.
You know?
Oh, yeah. He completely misjudged the situation. When he was sent to prison, he thought he'd have a much easier time if he went to a psychiatric prison. And he pretended to be a psychotic, and he got his way. He was sent to a psychiatric prison where his life was infinitely worse. And because he did such a good job of pretending to be a psychotic, he couldn't get them to believe that he wasn't a psychotic. And he spent the rest of his time in prison there. He even tried to go on a hunger strike, and they fitted him with a nasal tube to keep him alive. He felt that he was being tortured by being in that prison, that his human rights were being violated.
Right, right. It's such a bizarro worldview for him to have, too.
But so many people believed it. So many people actually bought into this notion that this man who was, you know, an example of the Nietzschean chaos, where, you know, the new order comes out of chaos and blood, that he shouldn't have been put in that position, that he should never have gone to jail in the first place.
And that's something interesting when it comes to your book discussions, because I think it opens up this broader discussion about we can deal with these sort of very dark taboo topics, but there's that line we have to balance between,
right,
where some people we can discuss it seriously if we want, but then there's a whole nother side where you can run the risk of ending up fetishizing this kind of thing.
Right. And I hope I don't necessarily fetishize it, but
I don't think you do.
Well, you know, but I look at it from the perspective of anybody who's basically spent her productive adult life doing nothing but discussing the weird has probably fetishized it to a certain extent. But I do find a certain, and this actually does irritate some people, that I inject a certain level of my own personal morality into it as I go along. Like Peter Sotos, for example, his work probably should be accepted on its own merit, and I shouldn't maybe necessarily shouldn't try to apply my own experience or my own moral reaction to it, but it's impossible not to.
Could you give a little background on Sotos real quick?
Peter Sotos created a zine in the 80s called Pure, and it became notorious because he used a piece of child pornography in one of the editions of it. It was the zine itself was dedicated to serial killer culture and sexual violence and very outre taboo ideas. He was the first person convicted under a child pornography possession law in 1988. He didn't produce child pornography. He didn't create it. He simply used that picture, and then the magazine was distributed. That's where most of his notoriety comes from. His work to me is very important because there are very few people out there who are willing to examine or portray the extremity of experience the way that Peter Sotos does. Because of who I am and what I've experienced in life, I apply a different filter to it than he does. But I think that regardless of who you are, if you can approach the text from the mindset of, we are looking at a mindset, not an advocacy, people would understand and like his work so much more. Or at least they may not like it, but they would certainly understand it quite a bit more. His work is very important to me in that regard. But I do apply a morality to it that probably isn't necessarily needed or warranted.
Well, it's interesting. I remember talking to Jamie Gillis a few months before Jamie died. And it was at a movie convention. I asked about Peter Sotos, and he sort of basically said to me that Sotos is really like self-hating about who he is, mm-hmm. and that he would probably agree with you that he's like a horrible person for the thoughts he has and all this stuff. Like, he almost has that same morality thing going on, but he doesn't know what else to write about. You know, he knows that he has that darkness in him.
And see, the thing is I have that darkness in me too, and that's one of the things that that's come up before, is the fact that I think one of the good things about my site is that it sort of democratizes extremity in a way that enables people to look at these books in a different way, or at least I hope it does for some people. Because, you know, here I'm sort of this maternal suburbanite woman with my cats and my quilting and everything. And if I'm reading these books and I'm saying that I too have unsettling thoughts or interesting obsessions, that perhaps people won't be so afraid of these sorts of ideas in these books when they encounter them, or they won't be so afraid to tell others about these books when they read them. So if Peter Sotos, I don't know if he's self-hating or not, but the thoughts that he has are thoughts that a lot of people have. And these people are just like me. They're people who live relatively normal, on the outside, if you were to apply a moral scale to my life, I guess I'd come across as being a relatively moral person. And democratizing extremity of idea and belief so that people don't feel like they are doing something wrong simply by reading a book is important, I think.
Yeah, and for my part, self-hating may not have been exactly what Jamie said. I think he said that Sotos is very hard on himself because of who he is.
Now, I get that, because I have that same notion that there must, on some level, be something very wrong with me as a human being, that I seek out some of the darkness that I do. I guess that's just part of humanity. Some of us seek out the dark, others seek out the light. But I have that same sort of sense that I may not hate myself, but I certainly question myself and wonder if there's something wrong with me at times, you know?
Well, what's odd about Sotos too, is he's probably one of the he's one of the only authors that I know that is extremely sympathetic towards the radical feminist Andrea Dworkin.
Yeah, he is.
You know, which is odd coming from him, yeah.
Well, she had that extremity of experience, didn't she? And she shared it in detail. She was willing to, like, bleed on the page, which is what he does, too. I still am not a fan of Andrea Dworkin. I don't think I ever can be. I'm not that into the whole radical feminist movement, but I have a whole different sympathy for her now after reading some of what Sotos has had to say about her, because she did. She was open and honest and permitted people to see into terrible portions of her life that most people would have preferred not to politicize or share. And of course, some of that stuff has come into question later as to whether or not it was, it actually happened. But gosh, she could tell a terrible story. And if you were a person prone to liking to read dark stories, you could do a lot worse than picking up an Andrea Dworkin book.
Well, it's interesting too, because a lot of it has come into question, but at times I've felt that, and I'm not like a proponent of Andrea Dworkin's way of thinking mm-hmm. about things either, but when people say things like, oh, well, there's no way she could have been raped because she was ugly or she was fat, I'm like, I don't know if that's necessarily the case, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of the question came into not necessarily that she was ugly or fat, but just, and God help me, I know I'm doing the cardinal thing here. I am not immediately believing a woman's story, but there were a lot of red flags in the drugging story that she gave that that made people, even her own husband, I forget his name, not to believe her. I don't know enough about it to where I can say one way or the other. I know that there are people who came out and said that she flat out was never a prostitute. Again, I don't know how much credence we can give to anybody who naysays, because Andrea Dworkin was such a polarizing person that I think a lot of people would be really happy to discredit just about anything she said.
Right, right. It's difficult to parse out. I think she's an interesting writer of extremity, regardless of whether we agree or disagree with her.
Right, and she had some very interesting views on pornography, views that I actually don't know where I stand on it, but her and Catherine McKinnon's look at what they considered to be violent and vulgar pornography was definitely eye-opening. So, and again, it was just as salacious as anything that, as just about any other book I could think of. If you wanted to read about, again, about terrible things, those are some books you should pick up.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually a theory going around that Angela Nagel has sort of hinted at, that, you know, some of this alt-right 4chan stuff may be driven by young men who have watched so much of this, like, so-called gonzo porn that it's traumatizing to them, and they end up pushing in this, like, extremely puritanical direction as a result.
You know what? That's something that I thought about too. That if you look at the millennials and I guess Generation Z, who's after the millennials? These are kids who grew up in a significant amount of chaos. I mean, the Gen X parents we did our best, I think, but in a way, we didn't do too much better than the boomers. When you live in continual chaos caused by divorce, moving around, poverty, general instability, you're going to kind of, again, like Breivik, long for the 1950s where everything seemed like it was so orderly. And I can see if you, oh God, how horrible is that, that if you were a kid and the way you learned about human sexuality was by watching gonzo porn? I mean, that's awful. And I can see exactly why somebody would want to, you know, return to the land of Leave It to Beaver after, if that was their primary exposure to sexual relations.
Right, right. Although I kind of even have to push back on that, at least in the sense that, you know, I mean, the things like infidelity and things have always existed, even gross kind of sex has always existed even before, you know, gonzo porn was a thing, you know. We can't just, like, wave a wand like Pat Buchanan would want to do and, you know, go back to the magical 50s.
Well, you know, I don't know that, well, yeah, I guess. I guess if you, I guess I lump, you know, infidelity in with, in a different category of deviance than, like, you know, a 10 guy gangbang, you know, that kind
no,
of
no, no, I agree with you, but someone like Pat Buchanan is all about, like, the traditional Christian values and, you know, yeah, Leave It to Beaver type thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the people who are telling you to be moral the most are generally the ones who need the morality, but that's the way it's always been. I mean, I don't think I can think of a single president who hasn't had a mistress except for maybe Obama. I don't, and Carter. I think power tends to lead to the sense that you have to have an affair. I don't know why, but it does.
Well, I think JFK proved that pretty
well. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely.
So the last thing or two I wanted to ask you, what authors have been on your radar lately? Odd authors that you would recommend to listeners and readers?
Actually, lately I have been reading mostly books, manifestos. Like Sky Manifesto by Valerie Solanas. I'm reading the Anti-Tech Revolution by Kaczynski. I just got finished reading Arthur Bremer's An Assassin's Diary. Bremer's the guy who wanted to kill Nixon, but he couldn't get close enough, so he killed
George Wallace.
Right, not killed him, he paralyzed him. And the movie Taxi Driver is based on Bremer's, loosely based on Bremer's story. But I've been reading mostly stuff like that. I'm trying to think of some of the more odd books that I've picked up lately. Chip Smith recommended repeatedly that I read Bruce Wagner's Dead Stars. I recommend that. That has been an interesting book. It's kind of it's a dark look at humanity and the way that the internet has caused people to want to achieve fame at all costs. And it's so delightfully awful. I love books where where the characters are beyond redemption in a way. And this is one of those books where everybody in it just seems terrible. And it's just been a hoot to read in little bits and pieces. I finished not too long ago a book called Eileen, and I couldn't pronounce the author's name on a bet. But it's another book just about absolute squalor. Every character in it is despicable. And it was one of those books that was just a pleasure to read for somebody who enjoys terrible characters and books that lack a redemption arc.
Are you going to be reading, you've talked about her book. She's married to David Cross. Her dad is the doctor
Amber Tamblyn?
From Twin Peaks. Yeah, she has a new book coming out, but you've also reviewed, what was the book you reviewed on Odd Things Considered by her?
Oh gosh. You know what? I don't remember what the title is. Hang on one second. Dark Sparkler. It was her collection of poetry about various women in the entertainment industry and the things that happened to them, both real and a few fictional characters she created. It was a pretty interesting book, and it was a book that caused me to rethink some of my own decidedly anti-feminist ideas about how women enter into the entertainment industry and how they're treated once they're there.
Right, right. And her new book, for anyone listening, is called Any Man, a novel, and it sort of flips the predator notion on its head. It's sort of like what Lydia Lunch did in her novel...
Paradoxia,
yeah, where... The woman is preying on the man.
A Predator's Diary or something. Paradoxia, Predator's Diary, I think is what that one was. No, I had...
Right, well, that's what Any Man is going to be like, according to what I've read about it, the new Amber Tamblyn novel.
Oh, no, I hadn't heard of it, so I will have to put that on my radar as well. I have a huge wish list, so I'll add that to it, so I won't forget.
And I was going to ask you about one more author,
sure.
Because I know we're both familiar with her. Could you tell us a little bit about Anne Sturzinger, because I hear you're a fan of hers.
Oh, I love Anne Sturzinger. Her book Nosquam is, in its way, sort of a defining book of the Gen X culture and how it resolved in the adults who lived through it and truly absorbed the messages of that culture, that we were all supposed to grow up to be rock stars, that we were all supposed to be famous, and that anything less than the sort of the sort of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the sort of squalor that goes along with being a famous rock musician, that any life less than that was distasteful to the protagonist of this novel, Lester. And the way that he runs roughshod over everyone around him in his attempts to make sense of the life that he has, a pretty good life, I think, from most people's perspectives, was to me, like I said, I think it is one of the defining novels of the Gen X culture, right up there with Fight Club, really, in the way that it just sort of distilled the angst and the anger of the everyman, the Gen X everyman's inability to achieve exactly what it was he wanted with his life. And I think that she is one of the more clever, erudite writers working today. And her translation of Octave Mirbeau's In the Sky is of course, it's his work, but her translation of it, God, that is a gripping book. You would just have to read my review of it, because I have a hard time articulating how much it affected me to be able to read a translation of a work and have that translation still resonate so strongly and to affect me emotionally the way it did was a very remarkable accomplishment. I think very highly of her work. I have one of her books, The Talkative Corpse, and I think Girl Detectives are in my to be read file. And she has another book out too, the one that caused the controversy because of the Netflix situation.
Yes.
I got to read an early version of that, and like there are parts of the book that like were heartbreaking to me, but like the last third of the book was some of the most hilarious fiction. It had to have been hilarious. She's a very funny writer, but yeah, I haven't read the edited version that's gone to press, but I did get to see it beforehand. Deeply. She's one of those people who can look at the surface of everything and see so accurately what's below and tell it, that a person like me who doesn't have that talent almost has a difficult time summarizing it. But she is a remarkable writer, and it's a shame that she isn't better known than she is. I recommend just about anything that she writes.
And I was going to mention the controversy with Life is that basically Anne wrote Life years before the Netflix series Altered Carbon.
Right.
And yet Altered Carbon seems to have stolen everything, or at least came up with the same idea way after her.
Yeah, sometimes that happens, I guess, where simultaneously ideas erupt. I know that there are examples of that in like books about coincidence and things like that. But it did seem pretty odd. I mean, I don't know how they would have gotten their hands on it, but it did seem pretty odd, and it had to have been incredibly demoralizing to have had this idea that you had difficulty getting publishers to pay attention to, and then suddenly out of nowhere, oh, look, it's a TV show now. It had to have been extremely demoralizing for her to have to go through that, to realize that her work was actually that good, but here, we're going to do something else with this idea instead of yours. So, yeah, that would have sucked.
Yeah. Anne's probably going to hear this episode, and it's funny because I don't think Anne and I agree on anything politically necessarily, but damn, is she a hell of a writer.
Yes, she is. Yeah, you know, she and I occupy very different political spaces. I'm an extremely liberal person, and I'm a feminist, so yeah, we don't necessarily agree on a whole lot of political views, but one of the things I like about her is she permits debate, and I think that's one of the things I respect about anybody these days, is if no matter how much I think your idea may suck, as long as you discuss it and let me discuss it with you, you're going to be ultimately okay in my book, as long as you know you don't kill children or want to persecute people on the basis of religion or something like that, you know?
Well, in fairness, her views aren't like so far off the beaten path that like they're completely offensive. She's more like I always tell her she's like the new version of Florence King from the National Review. She's a conservative misanthrope.
Oh yeah, that's a good way. Yeah, well, yeah, I guess I would be a liberal misanthrope. So maybe that's why maybe that's why I get along with her.
Best of both worlds.
Right, exactly.
So I want to leave my listeners on a good note, on a sort of wrap-up note. Why would you recommend that listeners sort of delve into the areas you've delved into, these sort of outre books? What can they get out of it? Or maybe you'll tell them they shouldn't get into it. I don't know.
You know, not everybody's going to be into it, and that's cool. And I don't know that my writing is going to be to everybody's taste, because the subtitle to my book is, it's TLDR, Too Long Didn't Read, because I do go on at length, so I don't know necessarily that my point of view on my site would be worthwhile to people, but you never lose anything by reading an idea that is counter to your own. You never lose I'm having a hard time coming up with, it's like I'm trying to justify my existence sort of in a way, like, why is it exactly you should read the books that I've based my life around? And it's because ideas are important. You're going to filter through some of them and think some of the ideas are garbage. You're going to think some of them are dangerous. You're going to think some of them are brilliant but unworkable. You're going to think some of them are the best thing you've ever heard. But you're never going to get to make those evaluations if you don't open the book. And I think that that's something that everybody's got to do. You just got to open the book, whether it's conspiracy theory, whether it's religion. There are ideas out there that even if you don't agree with them, they're going to spark thinking in your own right to where you're going to be able to achieve a sense of peace, like the whole thing you were talking about with antinatalism. It's not necessarily something that I believe in either. I think that anything that runs counter to the way human beings naturally live, like human beings want to reproduce, it's just sort of something that's innate in us, is never going to be particularly workable. And I tend to focus on that which is workable. But the book itself and its focus on why it is that we fear death and why it is that we fear suicide and why it is that we as a culture fight so hard against people who want to die, people who may have decided that life is no longer worth living because they're sick, and the extraordinary lengths that we go through to keep people alive helped me process my mother's unfortunately terrible death in a way that had I not read that book, I would have been lost. I was able.
Which book? Was it Every Cradle Is a Grave by Sarah Perry?
Correct. I'm sorry. I thought I didn't give the title of the book. But yeah, it was. It gave me a framework to be a witness to something that was terrible that was happening and to process what was happening, realize why it was terrible, and walk away with a sense of peace knowing that there are worse things than dying. So I don't think that anybody would have expected to open a book about the philosophy of antinatalism and be able to find words that give you peace about your mother's illness and her death was pretty rough going through it. It gave me an entirely new framework to process information that in the past would have been difficult because I would have been forced to accept everybody's platitudes of, oh, well, this is God's will, or this is how she would have wanted it, or she's such a tough fighter, you know, kind of comments that people make that aren't particularly helpful and sort of actually dehumanize the dying. Who would have thought that I would get this framework from a book about antinatalism? But I did. And I think that that's probably the thing people should take away from my site is you never really know what truth and revelation you're going to find until you pick up the book and read it. So don't necessarily dismiss something out of hand. Strange ideas can eventually be synthesized and filtered into your worldview in a way that you may not expect.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. I want to thank you again for coming on the show, Anita Dalton.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Anita Dalton of Odd Things Considered. Be sure to check out her blog, and if you have some cash, definitely buy TLDR, The Best of Odd Things Considered, out now from Nine Bandit Books. Keeping with the general theme of oddness, we've got a really odd track for you to close out the show. It's a cover of Tiny Tim's Tiptoe Through the Tulips by the punk band Ism, and featuring the late Tiny Tim himself. Until next time, keep it odd.